readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and this week, we're going to cross the line. Scandal? No, though that would be fun. But this is fun, too, and just in time for holiday gift ideas. We'll be featuring writers who've topped the Times bestseller list and then took up crafting novels for young adults. And, of course, we'll look at some famous names who went the other way, like She Who Cannot Be Named, right, Harry, Hermione, and Ron? It's time for some genre jumping, fun for all the ages, as we turn to page one of the book report. Been dreaming of a new kitchen? One right for the way you cook, for optimizing your space and your unique style? Lifestyles Kitchens has a menu of options that work within your budget. Lifestyles Kitchens is one of New England's top design studios. Our professional designers come to your home, assess your space, cooking style, and guide you through a wide world of choices. Then we'll design the perfect kitchen or bath with you. Start with cabinets from Woodmode, Brookhaven, Candlelight, DBS, or Neff. Add exquisite counters of granite, engineer stone, and finish with fabulous fixtures. Your dream kitchen doesn't come out of a box or a big box store. And since 'tis the season to make dreams come true, Lifestyles Kitchens offers full or partial gift certificates. Contact us today at lifestyleskitchens.com. That's two S's. lifestyleskitchens.com. Happy holidays! Between popular suspense novels, Ridley Pearson mixes it up with my great friend Dave Barry as co-authors of Peter and the Starcatcher. Right now, let's preview Ridley's latest action novel, The Risk Agent. Here's the story. Grace Chu is an American-educated Chinese national now working as a forensic accountant. Her skills go way beyond number crunching. She served in the Chinese Army as an intelligence officer. John Knox is an American who parlayed his military service in Iraq into a lucrative import-export business, an enterprise which now provides him the access he needs to work freelance undercover ops. Grace and Knox meet for the first time in Shanghai. The security firm they work for is hired to retrieve a kidnapped employee who, if not found, could result in the failure of a multi-billion-dollar real estate deal. The stakes are high, and Grace and Knox find themselves dead center in an international affair. Tom Habercorn narrates.
The 24th floor corner office overlooking the bustling Hong Kong harbor and, on the opposite shore, Kowloon, was spacious, its appointments comfortable. Three flat panel screens surrounded a sitting area, one displaying a black and blue logo of Mirror Image Ours, beneath which was written, Rutherford Risk Security Matters. Brian Primer ran Rutherford's Risk's Asian division. He wore a golf tan beneath a full head of hair, his face punctuated by gray, flinty eyes. Turning to his left, he addressed David Dulwich, one of his six key field operatives, picking up on Dulwich's reference to a takeaway food container in a photograph. It was but one of many photographs on the coffee table between them, along with a brown paper takeout food container with a wire handle.
"Jesus,"
said Alan Marquardt, the boyishly handsome 45-year-old CEO of construction industry giant The Berthold Group. Marquardt sported a tailored suit with a blue pocket square and matching tie. The corner of a China Air ticket envelope peeked out from his breast pocket. He was reacting not to the photo, but to the memory of opening the food container less than 10 hours earlier and discovering its contents. A photograph of two men, a Chinese holding a newspaper and an American holding his broken arm, taken against the backdrop of a hung bedsheet, a carefully folded ransom note, two plastic bags, each containing a single Q-tip. Dulwich said, "The one on the right, he's ours. Cletus Danner. He was keeping tabs on Mr. Liu. Must have walked into this. Both alive at the time of the photo. Confirmed POL. Proof of life, he means," Primer informed Marquardt. You'll get up to speed on the acronyms quickly. Anything you don't understand, just ask.
Like why somebody would do this?
Marquardt asked. It's a business. Don't personalize it. U.S. concerns paid out $400 million last year in ransom in Mexico alone.
Come on.
At 39, Dulwich had a face lined with worry and consternation. A fleshy scar that looked like melted wax climbed out from beneath the T-shirt he wore under his open-necked Oxford button-down. The Q-tips are assumed to be DNA swabs, Dulwich said. We're running them now. Another 2 days, minimum. But they'll come back Lou Howe and Cletus Danner. Used to be you sent a severed finger for the sake of the print. We haven't seen swabs used before. Our takers are young, educated, and enterprising. Seems a stretch for a triad, an organized gang, though not out of the question. Whatever the case, it's very clever, and tells us these are not people to mess with. We want to get this handled and get both hostages home ASAP.
We've just heard The Risk Agent by Ridley Pearson. Peter and the Sword of Mercy is book 4 of the Starcatcher series by Dave Barry and Ridley Pearson. And just in case you're headed to the Big Apple at holiday time, Peter and the Starcatcher, the Broadway play, has won 5 Tony Awards. But to the book. The year is 1902, 23 years since Peter and the Lost Boys returned from Rondoon. Since then, nobody on the island has grown a day older, and the Lost Boys continue their friendship with the Mollusk tribe and their rivalry with Captain Hook. Meanwhile, in London, Molly has married George Darling and is raising 3 children, Wendy, Michael, and John. One night, a visitor appears at her door. It's James, one of Peter's original Lost Boys. He's now working for Scotland Yard and suspects that the heir to the throne, Prince Albert Edward, is under the influence of shadow creatures. These creatures are determined to find a secret cache of star stuff, which fell to London many centuries ago. The star stuff is hidden in an underground vault, which only has one key. The Sword of Mercy, a legendary weapon kept with the crown jewels. Molly is determined to locate and protect it, but when she goes missing, it's up to her 11-year-old daughter Wendy to keep it out of the other's clutches. Wendy has heard her mom's stories of a flying boy named Peter Pan. He may be her only hope of saving the world. The wonderful Jim Dale narrates.
Osborne House, Isle of Wight, England, January 22, 1901. Queen Victoria lay dying. At 81 years old, she had reigned over the vast British Empire for 63 years and 7 months, longer than any other British monarch. She had assumed the throne as a teenager, in an age of sailing ships and horse-drawn carriages. She was leaving a world that knew telephones, electric lights, and motor cars. The Queen lay on a large 4-posted bed, her eyes closed, her face peaceful. Close by stood her physician, Sir James Reed, and the white-haired Bishop of Winchester, who murmured a prayer. Gathered around were members of the royal family, including the Queen's son, Crown Prince Albert Edward. Upon her death, he would become king. The only sounds in the room, aside from the Archbishop's soft voice, were the ticking of a clock and the whispers of some of the smaller children, too young to feel the sorrow of the moment. Almost everyone stood near the Queen's bed. The lone exception was a tall, extraordinarily thin man, standing alone in a gloomy corner of the room. The man's gaze appeared to be focused on the Crown Prince. There was no way to know for certain, because the man wore eyeglasses with wire rims and lenses tinted a dark shade, almost black. He always wore these glasses, even at night. This was one of a number of strange things about him. People avoided the tall man. The Archbishop finished his prayer. Sir James stepped forward and bent over his patient. The room went utterly silent now, save for the ticking of the clock. At exactly 6:30 in the evening, Sir James stood and solemnly raised his hand. The onlookers immediately understood the meaning of this gesture. Queen Victoria was dead. Some gasped, some moaned, others simply bowed their heads. The Archbishop began the benediction. From inside the cluster of mourners, one of the younger children, a girl of 5, peered around her mother's dress at the tall man in the corner. She had been keeping an eye on him. Like most children who found themselves in his presence, she felt afraid of him, though if pressed, she could not have said why. As the little girl watched, the tall man beckoned toward the open doorway. A second man entered, short, bald, and stocky. The girl could tell by the hesitant way in which the shorter man approached that he too was wary of the tall man. The man with the dark glasses leaned over and said something quietly to the short man, who then nodded and quickly left the room.
We just heard Peter and the Sword of Mercy by Dave Barry and Ridley Pearson. With 50 million books in print worldwide, I'm betting you've read one of Harlan Coben's books. His last 5 novels, Stay Close, Livewire, Caught, Long Lost, and Hold Tight, all debuted at number 1 on the New York Times bestseller list. Coben was the first author to win the Triple Crown of the Edgar Award, Seamus Award, and the Anthony Award. His novels have been called ingenious by the New York Times and poignant and insightful by the LA Times. In early books, Coben immersed himself in the exploits of sports agent Myron Bolitar. Branching out, he wrote the critically acclaimed Tell No One, which became one of the most decorated thrillers of 2001. The novel was also turned into a hit French film of the same name. Coben was the first writer in more than a decade to be invited to write fiction for the New York Times op-ed page. His essays and columns have appeared in many top publications. His first young adult novel was Shelter, and the second in the Mickey Bolitar series, Seconds Away, will kick off our conversation. Welcome, Harlan. Thanks so much for stopping by the Book Report today.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Okay, first question. What made you pick up the pen to write for young adults?
Well, there's a few different things, but I have 4 children myself, ages, the oldest just turned 18, the youngest is 11. So I think I wanted to write something that would be relevant for them. But I think the bigger reason was I had seen some great books, great young adult books on dystopia or vampires or wizards, but I hadn't really seen too many that do sort of what I do, the classic kind of thriller set in the real world that maybe some of the other kids could relate to. I thought maybe they'd enjoy that sort of stay-up-all-night suspense that I try to write for adults.
Well, parents worry that kids' literacy has devolved into 3-word texts, yet you've boldly jumped into YA literature, and you're in very good company. Share your take on the literacy of the younger generation.
I'm actually a lot more bullish on that than most people. I don't remember as a kid, quite frankly, the sort of general excitement about any book the way that we experienced when the kids started with the Harry Potter books, the Hunger Games books, Rick Riordan's Percy Jackson series. These became almost cultural phenomenons. I don't really remember that happening so much when I was a kid, to be on their side. And what I also love and what I hope will happen with my own books, Shelter and Seconds Away, my own young adult series, is that both the adults and the young adults are reading it. That's sort of amazing. I run into tons of adults that are reading Twilight or Hunger Games or Harry Potter, and then their kids are reading them also, and then they can share them. And so it's easy to say, oh, kids don't read today, blah, blah, blah. But I'm finding that they're actually pretty good about it if you give them books that they want.
Okay, tell us about Mickey Bolitar.
Well, Mickey is, he's 15, 16 years old. His father is dead. His mother is in rehab, or so we believe. And as the first book opens in the series, the creepy lady down the street, you know, every town has that creepy house with the creepy lady that we're all afraid of. Do you remember that when you were growing up, right?
I do.
Like that in your neighborhood?
Yep.
Everyone does. She opens the door, looks out at him his first day going to a new high school and says, Mickey, your father's not dead. He's alive. And so begins Mickey's journey. He is actually, for those who read my adult novels, he is the nephew of Myron Bolitar, who features in my adult novels. And he lives with Myron, who plays a secondary role in the series.
Well, I love the way Mickey enters a kind of nirvana when he plays basketball. Was basketball a part of your life?
It was. I played college basketball, actually Division III, and I wasn't all that good. But yes, basketball was a big part of my life. And again, that was part of what I hoped would be realistic and relate to the young adults, is that while Mickey is really solving huge crimes and has missing girlfriend and surrounded by all this danger, he still really cares about making the basketball team and playing well and trying to practice the sport that he loves. Instead of all the normal sort of problems that a high school kid has while still trying to solve this incredible mystery of where his father is and what really happened to him.
Well, I loved Emma with one M and the very quirky Spoon. Talk a little about them.
Well, first of all, the character of Spoon, this is why it's so great to have kids when you're writing young adults. The character of Spoon came exactly from a story that my son, when he was starting a new high school, told me it happened to him the very first day of school. When he came home and told me this story, I actually said, whoa, slow down. I got to write this down, because what did the kid say to you exactly word for word? And so I created the character of Spoon from a story that my son had told me. And a lot of the things in the books are things that my kids tell me that I just sort of twist around, or things that I think are done wrong or right in the high schools and the experiences that my own kids have come through. Ema, too, was, and on the outside, she's the goth girl, the outsider, but there's really a lot more to her. I always love that with characters, too, where they appear to be one thing, but really as you get to know them, there's something else.
Your longtime readers adore Myron Bolitar. Who was your inspiration for him?
Well, writers don't normally like to admit this, but Myron Bolitar is me, with plenty of wish fulfillment. I mean, he's funnier, he's faster, he's stronger, he thinks of the line I wish I had thought of, because I have all the time in the world. He's braver, I think he's more loyal. I do have him beaten two ways. One, I'm a better dancer, which I'll demonstrate, but we're on the radio. And two, he is slightly wiser in the ways of women. I'm slightly wiser in the ways of women. I've been with my wife for many years, and Myron's love life is a disaster. But a lot of his sensibilities and a lot of the things that I created for him apply to me. The couple of big differences, though, that I ended up doing, somewhat serious, is I gave him in his life what I've always wanted, but I have what he always wants. Myron's dream in life is to get married and move to the burbs and have kids. So he's constantly envious of me because I have that and he doesn't. On the other hand, I lost my parents at a fairly young age, and Myron has this wonderful relationship with his own parents that I imagine I would be having had my parents survived. So I'm envious of him. And this has worked well as I've written the Myron Bolitar series to I think make the series a little richer and a little different than just a guy solving crimes.
Interesting. Okay. Is Mickey going to return in another title?
Yes. We have Shelter is the first, Seconds Away is the second, and I do plan on at least a third, maybe more. I'm not quite sure if I'm going to wrap up the whole mythology by then or not.
Well, in doing research for this interview, I saw you had some pretty famous classmates. Can you tell us a high school story about New Jersey Governor Chris Christie?
Well, I've known Chris since I was 10 years old. We've been friends since we were 10 years old. We both turned 50 this year. We were both at each other's birthday parties celebrating that milestone. So it's almost 40 years of friendship. Have we always gotten along? Nope. Do we always agree on everything? Nope, which is really, I think, what makes it strong. But when we were both in high school, interesting enough, our senior year of high school, I was president of the student council, and he was president of the senior class. And you would end up guessing which one of us would go into politics and which one would make up stuff for a living. So sometimes I'm not sure that's a big difference. But he was really good at it, and he took care, and he wanted to know what everybody else thought. And I was more, let's just say, laissez-faire. I was more, a classical John Lockean liberal, where I was liberal in the sense that I didn't do anything at all. I let them run themselves.
And actually, you're pretty, you have a relationship with Dan Brown?
Yeah, we were in the same fraternity in college, at Amherst College, interestingly enough. At the time, neither one of us really had any, could not imagine that we would both be where we are today, writers, and doing as well as we seem to be doing. But yes, we were in the same fraternity when we were in college. And in fact, Dan sent me a very early draft, the manuscript of Da Vinci Code, because his books before that had not done as well as they should have. I felt that this is a guy who's going to break out big, and I couldn't understand why. And then I read Da Vinci Code in manuscript form, and I said, ooh, this is going to do some good things for you, Dan.
Yeah. So what are you working on right now?
Well, I just worked on another book. I have my next one, which will be out in March. I'm finishing up now. It's called 6 Years. It's for adults. All new characters, and I'm really thrilled with it. I can't wait for people to try it. We're also working on I had a book called Tell No One, which was made into a really wonderful French film. I can say that because I didn't make the film. It's based on my book, which is readily available on Netflix, anywhere you want, Tell No One. And they're doing a Hollywood remake, and I'm working a little bit on that. And stuff like that. Byron Boletar might turn into a TV series in the next year. So plenty on my plate.
Yeah, and I know that Tell No One won an Audie for Best Mystery and Suspense also.
Yes, Steven Weber did a great reading, the actor from Best Known by for Wings still, but in a lot of different TV shows and movies, and just a terrific actor. And he's been a longtime reader, and I talked him into trying out Audio World, and he won the award for Best Audio right away for Tell No One, so
yeah.
There you go.
Well, Harlan, I have to say, I read Seconds Away, and I thought it was wonderful. So thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Great talking to you, Anne.
All righty, bye. And now, let's hear a sampling of Seconds Away, narrated by Nick Podell.
This, I pointed to the photograph, is the Butcher of Luge? Yes. And you think he died at the end of World War II? That's what I was told. She said, Mickey, do you know something? I flashed back to the first time I had seen the Bat Lady. I had been walking to my new school when she suddenly appeared in the doorway of this decrepit house. I almost screamed out loud. She raised a ghostly hand toward me and said 5 words that struck me in the chest like a body blow. Mickey, I had no idea how she knew my name. Your father isn't dead. That was what had started me down this crazy road that now led to this picture. I looked up from the photograph. Why did you tell me that? Tell you what? That my father isn't dead. Why did you say that to me? She was silent. Because I was there, I said, my voice trembling. I saw him die with my own 2 eyes. Why would you say something like that? Tell me, she said in that creaky old voice. Tell me what you remember. Are you for real? The old woman silently rolled up her sleeve and showed me the tattoo that marked her as a survivor of the Auschwitz death camp. I told you how my father died. She said, now it's your turn. Tell me what happened. A chill ran down my spine. I looked around the dark room. A vinyl record spun on an old turntable, scratching out a song called Time Stand Still by Horsepower. My mom had been a Horsepower fan. She had even partied with the group back in her celebrity days before I came along and washed all her dreams away. On the Bat Lady's mantle was that cursed picture, the one of the 5 hippies from the 60s wearing tie-dyed shirts with that butterfly on the chest. Tell me, Bat Lady said again. I closed my eyes and took a deep breath. It was so hard to go back there, and yet it seemed as though I did it every night. We were driving to San Diego, just my dad and me. The radio was on. We were laughing. That's what I remember best from, well, before. the way he laughed. "Okay," she said. "Then what happened?" "An SUV crossed the divider and crashed head-on into us. Boom, like that." I stopped for a moment. I could almost feel it. The horrible jarring, the strain against the seatbelt, the whiplash into sudden darkness. The car flipped over. When I woke up, I was trapped. Some firefighters were trying to free me. "And your father?" I looked at her. "You knew my father, didn't you? My uncle told me that my father visited this house when he was a kid." She ignored the question. "Your father?" she repeated. "What happened to him in the accident?" "You know what happened. Tell me." I could see him in my mind's eye. Dad was lying on his back. His eyes were closed. Blood was pooling around his head. My heart began to tremble. Bat Lady reached a bony hand toward me. "It's okay." "No," I snapped, anger entering my voice now. "It's not okay. It isn't even close to okay. Because, see, there was a paramedic working on my dad. He had sandy hair and green eyes, and eventually this paramedic looked up at me, and when our eyes met, he shook his head. Just once, and I knew. His expression said it all. It was over. My dad was dead. The last thing I saw was my father on a gurney, and that paramedic with the sandy blonde hair and green eyes, wheeling him away."
We've just heard Seconds Away by Harlan Coben. And for adults, Live Wire by Harlan Coben is book 10 of the fan favorite Myron Bolitar series. In this title, Myron had always fantasized about a voluptuous femme fatale walking into his office asking for help. The woman standing in his doorway now has killer curves, all right, but she's 8 months pregnant, which kind of ruins the fantasy. Former tennis star Susie T and her rock star husband Lex are both clients. Over the years, Myron has negotiated contracts for the power pair, but now Lex has disappeared. The very pregnant Susie is in tears, fearing the online rumors about the baby's paternity may have driven Lex away. For Myron, questions of fatherhood couldn't hit closer to home. As his dad clings to life, the brother who abandoned them many years ago is in trouble, and Myron's teenage nephew needs an authority figure. Myron is forced to confront deep secrets in his client's past and his own. Steve Weber narrates.
"The ugliest truth, a friend once told Myron, is still better than the prettiest of lies." Myron thought about that now, as he looked down at his father in the hospital bed. He flashed back 16 years to the last time he had lied to his father. The lie that caused so much heartbreak and devastation. A lie that started a tragic ripple that, finally, disastrously, would end here. His father's eyes remained closed, his breathing raspy and uneven. Tubes seemed to snake out from everywhere. Myron stared down at his father's forearm. He remembered as a child visiting his dad in that Newark warehouse, the way his father sat at his oversized desk, his sleeves rolled up. The forearm had been powerful enough back then to strain the fabric, making the cuff work tourniquet-like against the muscle. Now the muscle looked spongy, deflated by age. The barrel chest that had made Myron feel so safe was still there, but it had grown brittle, as though a hand pressing down could snap the ribcage like dried twigs. His father's unshaven face had gray splotches instead of his customary 5 o'clock shadow, the skin around his chin loose, sagging down like a cloak one size too big. Myron's mother, Al Bolitar's wife for the past 43 years, sat next to the bed, her hand, shaking with Parkinson's, held his. She too looked shockingly frail. In her youth, his mother had been an early feminist, burning her bra with Gloria Steinem, wearing T-shirts that read stuff like, "A woman's place is in the House and Senate." Now here they both were, Ellen and Al Bolitar. We're El Al, Mom always joked, like the Israeli airline. Ravaged by age, hanging on. Luckier by far than the vast majority of aging lovers, and yet this was what luck looked like in the end. God has some sense of humor. So, Mom said to Myron in a low voice, we agree. Myron did not reply. The prettiest of lies versus the ugliest truth. Myron should have learned his lesson back then 16 years ago, with that last lie to this great man he loved like no other, but no, it wasn't so simple. The ugliest truth could be devastating. It could rock a world. Or even kill. So as his father's eyes fluttered open, as this man Myron treasured like no other looked up at his oldest son with pleading, almost childlike confusion, Myron looked at his mother and slowly nodded. Then he bit back the tears and prepared to tell his father one final lie. Chapter 2. 6 days earlier. Please, Myron, I need your help. This was, for Myron, a bit of a fantasy. A shapely, gorgeous damsel in distress sauntering into his office like something out of an old bogey film. Except, well, the saunter was more of a waddle, and the shapeliness was coming from the fact that the gorgeous damsel was 8 months pregnant, and really, sorry, that kind of killed the whole fantasy effect. Her name was Susie T., short for Treventino, a retired tennis star. She'd been the sexy bad girl of the tour, better known for her provocative outfits, piercings, and tattoos than for her actual game. Still, Susie won a major and made a ton in endorsements, most notably as the spokeswoman, Myron loved that euphemism, for La La Latte, a chain of topless coffee bars.
We've just listened to a preview of Live Wire by Harlan Coben. Readers, frankly, I agonized over bringing you this one. Of course, The Casual Vacancy, J.K. Rowling's first novel for adults, is big news in the book biz. The reviews are all over the place. But I bet, like me, you've been wondering about it, so here goes. Padfoot is, at first glance, a charming English town, with a cobbled market square and an ancient abbey. But what lies behind the pretty facade is a town at war. Rich at war with poor, teenagers fighting their parents, wives battling their husbands, and teachers at odds with pupils. Sadly, Packford is very far from idyllic. An empty seat on the town's council soon becomes the catalyst for the biggest war the town has ever seen. Who will triumph in an election fraught with passion, duplicity, and unexpected revelations? Tom Hollander narrates.
A casual vacancy is deemed to have occurred, A, when a local councillor fails to make his declaration of acceptance of office within the proper time, or B, when his notice of resignation is received, or C, on the day of his death. Charles Arnold Baker, Local Council Administration, 7th edition. Sunday. Barry Fairbrother did not want to go out to dinner. He had endured a thumping headache for most of the weekend and was struggling to make a deadline for the local newspaper. However, his wife had been a little stiff and uncommunicative over lunch, and Barry deduced that his anniversary card had not mitigated the crime of shutting himself away in the study all morning. It did not help that he'd been writing about Crystal, whom Mary disliked, although she pretended otherwise. "Mary, I want to take you out to dinner," he had lied, to break the frost. 19 years, kids, 19 years, and your mother's never looked lovelier." Mary had softened and smiled, so Barry had telephoned the golf club because it was nearby and they were sure of getting a table. He tried to give his wife pleasure in little ways, because he had come to realise, after nearly 2 decades together, how often he disappointed her in the big things. It was never intentional. They simply had very different notions of what ought to take up most space in life. Barry and Mary's four children were past the age of needing a babysitter. They were watching television when he said goodbye to them for the last time, and only Declan, the youngest, turned to look at him and raised his hand in farewell. Barry's headache continued to thump behind his ear as he reversed out of the drive and set off through the pretty little town of Pagford, where they had lived as long as they had been married. They drove down Church Row, the steeply sloping street where the most expensive houses stood in all their Victorian extravagance and solidity. Around the corner by the mock Gothic church, where he had once watched his twin girls perform Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, and across the square, where they had a clear view of the dark skeleton of the ruined abbey that dominated the town's skyline, set high on a hill, melding with the violet sky. All Barry could think of as he twiddled the steering wheel, navigating the familiar turns, were the mistakes he was sure he'd made, rushing to finish the article he had just emailed to the Yarville and District Gazette. Garrulous and engaging in person, he found it difficult to carry his personality onto paper.
That was The Casual Vacancy by J.K. Rowling. Sharon Creech was the first American winner of the Carnegie Medal for British Children's Books and the first person to win both the American Newbery Medal and the British Carnegie. Sharon was born in Ohio, but frequently visited with family in Kentucky, a place which features prominently in her writing. At college, she became intrigued by storytelling after taking literature and writing courses. Later, she became a teacher of secondary school English and writing in England and Switzerland. Her first children's novel, Absolutely Normal Chaos, was published in 1990. A comedy about contemporary teen life, it featured a 12-year-old girl's complete and unabridged journal for English class. Her first book published in the U.S. was Walk Two Moons, which won the Newbery Medal in 1995. Today we're going to speak with her about her new work, her 18th book, The Great Unexpected. Welcome, Sharon. Thanks so much for joining us today on The Book Report.
Thank you. Happy to be here today.
I'd love it if you could introduce The Great Unexpected to our listeners by describing the main characters.
Ah, the main characters. Well, there are two stories that parallel each other. On one side, the main story involves two spirited orphan girls, Naomi and Lizzie. They're about 12 years old, and they live in the small town of Blackbird Tree in America. And for them, the unexpected has never been good. It's always been bad. Naomi is the thinker, and Lizzie is the chatterer of the two. And their story alternates with this parallel one of a cranky old lady who lives in Rook's Orchard, Ireland, and she seems to be hatching a plan, a mysterious plan. So she's a bit, she's cranky, she's older, she's wealthy, as opposed to the girls who seem to have come from impoverished backgrounds. They're both orphans. And so connecting the two stories, though, is a charming boy named Finn, who in the first chapter falls out of a tree at the feet of Naomi and Lizzie, and nothing is ever the same after that. But Finn also appears, at least an older version of Finn appears in the story of the cranky old lady. So there is this element going on of, is this the same Finn? Is it a different time? Is he the son of Finn? Is he real? Is he not real? And so that weaves through the story. So there's sort of very real American country kids and the eccentric Irish woman and this boy named Finn who falls in between.
Yeah, I have to say I read the book and I kind of love the cranky old lady. What age group has The Great Unexpected been written for?
Well, I don't write for a particular age group, but I tend to write about 12-year-olds. So the publisher usually recommends the book from 8 to 14.
Mm.
But usually that 8 to 12-year-old range, the sort of 4th, 5th, 6th grade, those are the readers, probably the most common readers that I have are in that age group.
Yeah.
how did winning the Newbery Award for Walk Two Moons, how did that change your life?
Oh, my gosh. In an instant, it changed it so much. I was at the time a headmaster's wife, a full-time teacher. I had two teenagers in school. I was trying to write my second book. I had finished Walk Two Moons and write my second book for young people and was having a lot of trouble. And I thought, you know, I had earned about $4 so far as a writer. And I mean, I really need to, this is an indulgence. I need to stop this and maybe take a second job. My kids were about to go off to college. And then a call came out of the blue when I was home alone in England. We were living in England at the time, and my husband was back in the States. And I just, even though I wasn't quite sure what the Newbery was, I knew that this somehow was momentous. Well, the way it changed my life is that it gave me a readership, and it gave me a reason to write. So the Newbery, every school in America will stock the Newbery book. Every bookstore will carry it. You have a source then not only of audience but of income, and that allows you then to write, to continue writing.
You began writing, I guess, in the late 80s and 90s. Has writing for children changed significantly? Have the themes changed?
Well, for me, no. I write the same stories, not the same stories, but because I'm always bouncing off of something that's currently happening. But I write in the same way, in the same sort of genres. But there certainly is, I think, books have changed for children, you know, sort of post-Harry Potter. You know, there's a lot more fantasy, a lot more longer books, a lot more action-adventure kinds of things, a lot more series. Kids have a really great choice now, I think, of books all over the map.
Yeah. Well, it does seem that Harry Potter opened the door for heavy-duty, full-length novels full of historical reference. What advice can you give parents who want to grow bookworms?
Ah, to read to them. When the time they're born, maybe even before they're born, read to them and let them see you reading. If you enjoy reading and you're curled up with a book often, then they will see it as something positive. But I think mainly reading to them, because you are giving them the skills to read themselves by, you know, the inflection, by the way you talk about a story afterwards, by just introducing them to books that they might not know about or read about or read. And then you extend that sort of range of things that they can read about.
You've written novels for adults. How does that compare to writing books for kids?
It compares in that they're very similar processes. When I'm writing about an adult, it's an adult book. When I'm writing about a child, it's a child's book. So as long as I stay in the perspective of the main character, that dictates the story and the viewpoint of the story, rather than some unknown criteria saying this is an adult book and this is a children's book. If you stay in the mind of a 12-year-old, for instance, you're going to deal with 12-year-old themes and not 40-year-old themes. So that, at least that's the way I approach it. The first two books I wrote were for adults, or about adults, I should say. And then the next book I wrote was Absolutely Normal Chaos, which is the journal of a 12-year-old girl. And I did not make that distinction that, oh, now I was suddenly writing for children. It was my agent who said, or actually the publisher she offered it to, said, you know, I think this is a children's book. And I thought, what's that? You know, what's the distinction there? I was teaching Shakespeare, Chaucer. You know, I wasn't really, my head wasn't in the realm of children's books, even though I had children and had read to them. But I thought, okay, what's the distinction here? And then I went to a writer's conference. And at that conference, it was solely, you know, it was about children's literature. And they had children's writers who wrote for children, like Lois Lowry, James Giblin, Dayton Hyde, and others. And it was a really beautiful world there, because I thought, well, it combines things I love most, children and writing and books and teaching. And so I sort of came away from that thinking, well, all right, so if I you know, maybe the book that I wrote is a children's book because it's about a 12-year-old and from the viewpoint of a 12-year-old. And at that time, the publisher who had just accepted that book asked for another one in that age range. And so that next book was Walk to Moons. And that was how I sort of opened up that door and walked down that path.
I see. Are you already working on your next project?
The next book will be called The Boy on the Porch, and I've just finished my revisions, and so now it's gone into copy editing. And it's a shorter book and a narrower focus. The Boy on the Porch just focuses on three people, two people who are caring for a boy who's been found on their porch. They don't know where he's come from or why he's there, and he doesn't speak. And so the whole focus of that story is, you know, where is he from? What's he about? What do we do with him?
Well, Sharon, I have to say that your book, again, is a wonderful, wonderful read. I enjoyed reading it. I know my daughter can't wait to pick it up. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. It was great to talk with you.
All righty.
Bye-bye.
And now, let's listen to The Great Unexpected as Newbery Medal winner Sharon Creech celebrates the thread that connects us all and the great and unexpected gifts of love, friendship, and forgiveness. Heather O'Neill and Aaron Moon narrate.
You didn't kill it, did you? It fell out of this here tree. I thought it was dead, but then it spoke, and now it's gone off again. I kneeled beside the body and put my hand on its chest.
Is it breathing?
Lizzie asked.
Take its pulse.
I held the body's wrist. I can feel something gurgling in there.
Oh my, then it's alive. Have you ever seen it before? What did it say when it spoke? Before it went off again?
Something about a rook's orchard, or maybe a crook's orchard? Lizzie's foot nudged the body's foot.
Maybe it was in an orchard place, and a crook tried to kill it, and so he hid in this tree, and then when you came along...
Maybe we should stop calling it an it. Lizzie studied the body's face.
Never saw it before, did you?
Nope.
Look in its pockets, Naomi. See if it has something with its name on it.
We've just heard The Great Unexpected by Sharon Creech. To quote Harlan Coben, our next book, Red Rain, is a slam-bang, stay-up-all-night, leave-the-lights-on thriller. R.L. Stine has scared kids for years. Now it's our turn. So, R.L. Stine, best-selling author of the incredibly popular Goosebumps and Fear Street series, some of the biggest-selling children's books of all times, delivers a terrifying new adult horror novel centered on the town in the grip of a sinister revolt. Travel writer Leah Sutter finds herself on a small island off the coast of South Carolina, the wrong place at the wrong time. A merciless, unanticipated hurricane cuts a path of destruction, and Leah barely escapes with her life. In the storm's aftermath, she discovers orphaned twin boys and impulsively decides to adopt them. The boys, Samuel and Daniel, seem amiable and immensely grateful. But Leah's family back on Long Island, husband Mark and their children, aren't quite so pleased. But no one could have anticipated the twins' true nature or predict that, within a few weeks' time, husband Mark will wind up implicated in two brutal murders. Michael Cerveris narrates.
Well, here I am on this island everyone calls mysterious and frightening, and I hope you are as curious as I am to find out if any of the stories are true. I tend to be skeptical. I have a bunch of older brothers who loved making up stories to terrify me, and I quickly learned not to believe any scary story anyone ever told me. I suppose it's odd to begin a travel blog by saying that no one comes here, but before I can begin to describe the unique charms and dark mystique of Cap Le Chat Noir, I really have to start with that fact. No one comes here. Of course, no one really believes the island is cursed, but there are too many frightening stories from its past to ignore. The dozens of Spanish ships that mysteriously sank off the island shores in the 1600s, the rumors of dark magic rituals, the stories that many believe to this day of the living dead walking the island in broad daylight. If you're an adventure traveler like me, those all seem like good things. But the fact is, no one has paid much attention to this island of whitewashed shacks, tall pine forests, fishing villages, and eccentric islanders, despite the fact that you can almost reach out and touch the place from the Outer Banks beaches of South Carolina. Located a hop, skip, and a splash from the Cape Hatteras National Seashore, vacationers have avoided Cap Le Chat Noir like, shall I say it, a black cat crossing their path. For you history nerds, here's the 411. The island was annexed by the English sometime around 1650. They had little interest in it, too small and too far from the mainland. Most English settlers chose the Roanoke colony to the north, and we all know how that worked out. Small groups of nomadic American Indians found their way to the island. Spanish pirates arrived later, sometimes unhappily, because they watched their ships go down just offshore. Yes, this part of the ocean is known as the Graveyard of the Atlantic. You can Google it. Don't bother to look for a reason why all the ships sank. No one can tell you. But this was the beginning of the island's bad reputation. When French traders arrived and heard the stories, they gave the island its unlucky name. I haven't been able to find out what they were trading, most likely rum or some concoction like it. The islanders I've met seem to drink from morning till night, and if that's your idea of travel adventure, go ahead. Pack your bags. I've saved the best, or worst, for last. Here's the most interesting historical detail, and it's definitely creepy, especially with frightening forecasts of a big hurricane heading this way. I don't want to talk about the hurricane now. I'm pretending it's not going to happen. You see, Le Chat Noir was devastated by one of the most powerful storms in hurricane history. It was the Labor Day hurricane of 1935, and I have every finger crossed that history is not going to repeat itself now. I heard the story of that dreadful hurricane shortly after arriving at Cap Le Chat Noir and stepping off the bouncing wooden dock. Believe me, folks, it did not exactly make me feel as if a welcome mat had been put out for me. The jeep taxi to take me to my hotel was late. Squinting in the bright sunshine, I glanced around. The dock area seemed to be deserted, except for two ragged-looking fishermen setting off in a tiny flat-bottomed skiff. Definitely no official tourist greeter waiting with a rum punch or even a friendly smile. I spotted a tiny brown shack across the dirt road with a sign Tea Shop. So, with suitcase, laptop case, and camera in hand, I made my way there to wait for my ride. Inside, the room was dimly lit, with red neon lights over the mirror at a bar and small glass lamps on each table. The tables were round cylinders like conga drums. Wall posters from tea companies provided the only cheeriness. I liked a poster that showed a grinning Chinese child holding a big steaming cup and the words, "How long since you oolong?" The place was totally empty. I took a seat at a table near the bar. I coughed, hoping it might summon someone from in back. A wooden overhead fan squeaked as it slowly made its rounds. An old woman emerged. White, bristly hair under a black bandana, pale skin tight over her cheekbones, silvery gray eyes, little hunched over. She wore a long black dress. Not exactly island wear. Without asking, she set a cup of dark tea down on my table with quavering hands.
That was Red Rain by R.L. Stein. Rick Riordan is the best-selling YA author of the Percy Jackson and the Olympian series, the Cain Chronicles, and the Heroes of Olympus. An astounding 30 million copies of these books are in print. In 2011, Rick was named Author of the Year by the Children's Choice Book Award. But did you know, Rick is also the author of the Trace Noir Mystery Series for Adults, winners of the Edgar, Anthony, and the Seamus Awards. Today we'll preview The Devil Went Down to Austin, Book 4 in the series. Trace has taken a short-term teaching job at the University of Texas at Austin. He's living with his brother Garrett, a computer wizard, and enjoying his life. But when Garrett's business partner is murdered, Trace must switch from professor to detective. As Trace delves into Garrett's bizarre world to find the truth behind the murder, he comes face to face with damaged relationships, violent lives, and billion-dollar schemes of a brave new high-tech world. Tom Stetschult narrates.
Lars Elder looked like a banker the way I look like a private eye, which is to say, not much. He was waiting on the porch of my family ranch house, flicking a switchblade open and closed, a computer disk and a can of Budweiser next to him on the railing. Lars' hairline had receded since I'd seen him last, but he still sported the earring, the Willie Nelson beard. His shirt, vest, and jeans were faded to the colors of a dust storm, and his eyes gave the same impression, dry and turbulent. "Trace," he said, "thanks for coming." "No problema." What I was thinking, the Navarre family banker drinking beer at 10 in the morning is not a good sign. Lars closed his knife, looked out toward the wheat fields. 50 yards away, past the tomato garden, the ranch caretaker was putting hay into the cattle feeder. Harold Diliberto stopped to watch us, his pitchfork suspended, dripping straw. "Harold showed me the work you've been doing inside," Lars said. "You've been spending a lot of time out here." "Some," I admitted. I tried not to feel irritated, like Harold had betrayed a confidence. Truth was, I'd been out at the ranch every weekend since the end of April, scraping old paint, filling in the spreading cracks in the original section of the house that had been my great-grandfather's homestead in the 1880s. I'd neglected both my jobs in San Antonio, ditched the cell phone, dropped out of my social life with little explanation to my friends. "Place was overdue for some maintenance," I told Lars. "You asked me out here for the Home Beautiful tour?" He didn't smile. "Talked to Garrett recently, maybe 4 or 5 months ago. But you'll see him soon. You're teaching that summer class in Austin, aren't you?" Another surge of irritation. "British lit for 6 weeks. May I ask how the hell you know about it?" Lars brought the switchblade up like a conductor's baton. "Look, I'm sorry I had to talk to you before you left. You know what Garrett's been up to? You mean like Buffett concerts, smoking pot, his programming project?" "Must have missed it. I tend to phase out when Garrett talks about RNI. Lars winced, like I just told him the price of an expensive gift. "Trace, Garrett isn't working at RNI anymore. He quit over a year ago." I stared at him. My brother had worked at the same software company for 16 years. He practically ran the place, took all the days off he wanted, had a retirement package. "Got himself involved in a startup company," Lars told me. "That was 2 years ago, spring of 98. Then last year, May of 99, he decided he couldn't keep working both jobs anymore. Garrett just left RNI. No severance, no benefits." "Not possible. He's working the startup with Jimmy Dobler." I studied Lars's eyes, tried to tell if he was joking. Apparently, he wasn't. And beer for breakfast started sounding like a good idea.
That was The Devil Went Down to Austin by Rick Riordan. Readers, I hope you found some gift ideas for friends and the youngins. My website, bookreportradio.com, has a sleigh full of top sellers of the season. Thanks for taking time from your busy holiday schedule to join me today. And in a week, at the same time, let's take another welcome break from holiday mayhem for the next edition of The Book Report.